Morning, Your Honors. This appeal grows out of an OSHA inspection into the partial collapse of a parking garage under construction in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which resulted in 4 worker fatalities. Petitioner Fabi Construction was a concrete subcontractor at the construction site. During the inspection, OSHA focused its attention very, very heavily on the issue of formwork. In this case, the metal shores that extended from one deck to another. And if you look at the record, you'll see that they were focused to a large degree on the number of shores on each floor, on the erection of the shores, on the inspection of the shores. That seemed to be the focus of their inspection. And when they issued their citation 6 months later, they issued 5 serious and 1 willful. Out of those, 5 of those citations were focused on the shoring itself, formwork. Now, during the litigation, and we're looking now at what was classified as the willful citation 2, item 1. The OSHA, the secretary, took the position consistently that citation was based on the premature removal of shores by Fabi on level 5. They took that position until the eve of trial, and at the eve of trial, they did 2 things. They dropped 2 of the shoring citations, obviously showing that there was a paucity of evidence to establish those 2 citations. And with respect to this key shoring citation, which was classified as willful, they changed their theory. The theory now became that the formwork not only consisted of the shores between each of the concrete decks, but also consisted of the concrete decks themselves, the permanent part of the structure. Judge, when the ALJ wrote her decision, she rejected the willful classification of citation 2, item 1, but she adopted the secretary's interpretation of the regulation at issue. And her adoption of that and her finding of a violation should be rejected for a number of reasons. First of which is the interpretation that temporary formwork now encompasses permanent structural elements of a garage is contrary to the plain wording of the plain language of the standard. And that's consistent with this court's decision in Lowendick and the United Aerospace Automobile decisions, both of which cases this court held that when you look at a standard, you look at whether or not the meaning that the secretary is arguing or that the judge has adopted is consistent with the plain wording of the standard itself. In this case, the judge in her decision ignored section 703E, which specifically addresses removal of formwork. Doesn't address it anywhere in her decision with respect to this particular citation. Now, obviously, if formwork can be removed, it can't be a permanent part of the structure. Interestingly,
what are you to make of your statement at page Roman 15 of your brief?
Page what, Judge?
Roman 15.
Okay.
The filigree system consists of precast concrete slab and beam that serve as a permanent formwork for the cast-in-place concrete poured on site.
Right.
Is that a slip of the pen?
Well, so in this case, what Fabi did is, instead of using the typical method, which is where you build wooden forms, they use the filigree method, which actually consists of a concrete tub which rests on the columns instead of the formwork resting on the columns. The fact that it's permanent.
So does that mean that on this job, the forms were indeed going to be left there?
The forms were
going to be permanent.
Yes. Yes. In this job, the slabs were going to become a permanent part of the structure. They were precast.
Yes. Is that what we're referring to? The filigree system?
Yeah, it's the slabs or the planks, whatever you want to call them. But the slabs were going to become a permanent part of the structure.
Okay. So
So, but Judge, if...
But you're saying that the term forms doesn't encompass permanent parts of the structure, right?
I'm saying that the standard that's been cited here, which is 703, section 703, obviously deals with temporary formwork. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a section specifically referring to removal of formwork.
Is there some other provision that would apply to this kind of permanent formwork?
No, Judge. I don't think there is any other provision that would refer to this kind of formwork, because what the standard talks about is the contractor's responsibility to design, erect, maintain formwork which is capable of supporting the anticipated loads. The effect of the judge's decision is to make the contractor an engineer, because the contractor, under her decision, is now responsible for designing the formwork, which includes the permanent structural elements of the building. Obviously, the results of that would be catastrophic.
Did you set forth those regulations in your brief?
Pardon me, Judge?
Did you set forth those the regulations in your brief? Like section,
yes.
703, where is that set forth in your brief?
Judge, I think it's, let me take a look. Well, in point one, we cite 703A1 on page one. And on page three, we cite 703E, which deals with removal of formwork.
Yeah, you cite them. Now, do you set forth their language in your brief somewhere?
I think 703E, we have quoted it in pertinent part, but it is almost...
Yeah, the norm on briefs here is that if you're relying on statutes or regulations, you either set them forth in your brief in its appendix, or you file a supplemental appendix with your brief that has them in it. And
I understand, Judge.
A lot easier
but
when
the, but the practice is that people who want to run away from the statute or the reg don't do that. And the people who want to rely on it do it. And so we have it in the government's brief. The
understood, end, Judge.
The very back end, unnumbered page, third page of that appendix. So this is the one, are we right, 1926-703?
Yes.
Okay, what provision of that?
And if you look at E, removal of formwork, this specifically deals with removal of forms and shores, which shall not be removed until the employer determines that the concrete has gained sufficient strength to support its weight and superimposed loads.
What's the exception in parentheses for?
Pardon me, Judge?
What is the, there's a parenthetical exception in that sentence. What does that refer to?
Well, slabs on grade would be a slab resting on the ground.
Okay.
I don't know what a slip form, honestly, I don't know what a slip form is.
Okay, but it doesn't refer to the slabs that on which you relied here.
No.
As part of the system. Mm-hmm.
No. It, in fact, Judge, in our brief, we talk about the fact that if you look at any construction code, if you look at any construction treatise, uniformly they refer to formwork as temporary structures. This argument advanced by the Secretary at the last minute, I think in order to salvage the citation when they realized that, in fact, their original allegation that there were inadequate shores on level 5 was simply not true, is the first time that this has been advanced and is absolutely at odds with the regulation itself, with construction treatises. And the regulation, Judge, and this is set out in our reply brief in pages, I think, 1 to 3, refers to an appendix, and the appendix says that any formwork which has been designed and fabricated in accordance with section 6 and 7 of the ANSI standard shall be deemed to be in compliance. We set forth at length in our brief that section 7 of the ANSI standard, which refers repeatedly to the removal of shores. So obviously a permanent structural element cannot be removed. And in her opinion, Judge, Your Honors, the judge says, she confirms that the Secretary's interpretation of the standard is strained, and yet she affirms it anyway. We cite several decisions, all of which hold that if it's a strained interpretation, it can't be a reasonable one. So by any, for any number of reasons, the citation to item one is premised on a reading of the statute of the regulation at issue, which is unreasonable and which is contrary to the plain wording of the statute. And if, in fact, you read it reasonably, which is to say that forms are temporary, or a formwork is a temporary structure, the judge concedes in her brief, in her opinion, that the formwork that was designed that day on October 30th, the day of the collapse, was capable of supporting the anticipated loads. She concedes that on A1703. So the that citation, her finding of a violation of that citation is contrary to law and should be reversed. With respect to the other citation, with regard to the placement of steel.
Yeah, would you do this? You refer to violation and other violation. Nowhere, I think, in your brief do you outline precisely what the violations are from which you're appealing. I don't know a place in your brief where you've got a succinct outline that says we were cited for taking away the shorings too soon, we were cited for not taking away something else we should have taken.
There's a chart. Where's the chart up here?
Yeah, actually. The chart is on
page.
Page double X.
Double X, yeah.
Okay. There we go.
And so if you would refer,
so citation,
as you're talking,
sure, Judge,
to that breakdown of the.
Sure. Yeah.
When you say the other violation, I'm having a hard time keeping up with which violation you're talking about.
Okay. The one that I had just addressed was citation to item one, mm-hmm. which was originally classified as willful, which was affirmed by the judge as serious. Citations three and four were dropped by the secretary just prior to the hearing. The citation with respect to the placement of reinforcing steel, the one that I just referred to as the other citation, is citation one, item one. And in that case, the secretary alleges that there were two types of steel that were improperly placed, mesh and the longitudinal bars. Now, first of all, the secretary cites, she can't find a standard that specifically applies to the placement of steel, so she cites the general duty clause mm-hmm. and says that that's a violation. The judge agreed with that. Mm-hmm. The general duty clause, one of the specific, the requisite elements of a general duty clause is general recognition in by both the industry and the employer or the employer of a hazard. Now in this case, that's the equivalent of knowledge of a hazard. In this case, we've got undisputed evidence of two different inspections, two different inspectors, specialists, who conducted daily inspections of the steel placement at the site. One was called Site Blavelt, and they had the shop drawings in their hands when they conducted the inspection. And the judge concedes in her decision that the right thing to do is to install the steel in compliance with the shop drawings. And number two was the City of Atlantic City, which was on site every day and inspecting the placement of the steel for compliance.
You're helpful, but your time is gone, and you're getting away from where I think you were in your argument. Now, the other violation to which you were referring, you're referring to item two of citation one?
No, Judge, citation one, item one,
yeah,
and that is the reinforcing steel.
Right.
And
what is the other violation you want to address, right?
And the last violation is...
That's the forms and chores.
...is citation one, item five.
Right.
And that's where the secretary cites 703E, which deals with the removal of shore work, mm-hmm. which the ALJ deals with in her decision on that citation, but with citation two, item one, she never mentions it. So she's obviously aware that it exists. But in finding that citation two, item one was violated, she never refers to the removal provision.
And citation two, item one is the violation you were talking about earlier, which concerns the definition of framework.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Your Honor, I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, the concern of the amici in this case is that two of the ALJ's rulings adopted by the commission have the effect of placing design responsibility on contractors, which is in fundamental opposition to the Spearon Doctrine, which controls basic law of liability and construction essentially throughout the United States and certainly including New Jersey at issue here. And the Spearon Doctrine, boiled down to its essence, says that the architect and engineers are responsible for designing, and if the contractor builds in accordance with those designs, it's not liable if there's a problem with those designs. And the...
Is there any limit on that? Gross negligence or anything?
Your Honor, I honestly can't.
If the shop drawings come in upside down by mistake and the building's put up upside down and collapses because the supports are on the roof instead of the under the building, surely there's something wrong.
Well, there may be, Your Honor, but the difficulty here, we've got the two violations, and Mr. Pranik has already discussed why the one on the shoring violates the regs itself. And if adopted, I mean, if it stands, the problem there was not in the temporary shoring. It was ultimately in the slabs that had already been laid. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it would effectively make the contractor responsible if those levels that's already laid turn out to be defectively designed. Even more perverse, though, in a lot of ways, is this general duty clause provision, because what the ALJ did was initially to recognize that it is industry custom and practice to build in accordance with the shop drawings.
But suppose, though, the shop drawings had not had the tubs or whatever kind of beams were involved entering into the column at all, and they had gone ahead and built according to that design.
Yes, Your Honor.
There'd be no violation in doing that?
There wouldn't be a violation of the general duty clause by the contractor.
You would say the contractor did not have any duty, even where the drawings were obvious to anyone in the industry that there was a defect in them.
Well,
they would still have no violation.
I think, Your Honor,
I think that's what Judge Ginsburg.
I think that potentially, if you could show that contractor on site, not imputed knowledge, but contractor on site had knowledge that a design was in fact dangerous, would fail.
Yeah, that's what
And
one way of showing that is to show by imputed knowledge that everybody in the industry knows that.
Let's
get back to the question that I think is troubling at least me and perhaps Judge Ginsburg.
Yes,
suppose the drawings are plainly creating a hazardous construction. You would say that by following the obviously incorrect drawings, they are protected from liability under general duty?
Unless you can show that the contractor had actual knowledge that they were dangerous, that they were defective and dangerous.
Well, can't actual knowledge be shown from on a sort of res ipsa basis? I mean, if the drawings are obviously defective and it would be clear to a layman, then surely it would be clear to an experienced contractor.
Well, factually, that may be correct, Your Honor. But if they're that obvious, then the contractor is going to speak up. In fact, the record.
But my implicit hypothetical, he doesn't. Otherwise, the question doesn't arise.
True, Your Honor. But what you have here is you've got this sort of imposing that because the ALJ pushes it so far that there's this presumption that every contractor is presumed to know customary construction methods in the contract industry and is supposed to be on guard lest any of the shop drawings are out of whack with the custom and practice for building. And if you don't spot that and bring it to the attention of the engineer and say, you screwed up. In other words, you are now responsible for double checking each and every element of design. And that is fundamentally at odds with the practice and with the Spearin Doctrine, which establishes the legal framework for how the industry is supposed to work. And that ultimately becomes pernicious. I can concede, and certainly as the court has probed appropriately, that you could have a case where there was actual knowledge on site and people just kept their mouths shut about something that was perfectly obvious. But those cases, in practice, I submit, aren't going to occur because contractors aren't interested in killing their employees or injuring and maiming their employees. And so what you end up with is cases like this where you have, after the fact, 20/20 hindsight saying, aha, you contractor should have known better. True, you built in conformance with the shop drawings, but you should have realized that the engineer had screwed it up. And because you didn't, you violated this general duty clause that simply says, ultimately, that you're responsible not to put your employees in a known hazardous situation. You're supposed to remove known hazards from the workplace.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Shortall for the Secretary of Labor. Substantial evidence supports the affirmance of the four violations that were found under the commission final order below. Two violations of the general duty clause for failure to properly place two types of reinforcing steel, mesh steel and longitudinal steel, and two violations of OSHA's concrete construction safety requirements.
I know I'm taking you out of the order you'd like to follow, but because time is limited, can you go to that question of the definition of formwork as including structural elements?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has that ever been used before anywhere?
I'm not aware. I know that the section has been cited before, but I'm not aware of in this particular.
Of formwork as including structural elements, has that ever been
it's
done?
It's the total system of support. And that
the formwork is generally used, as I understand it, to refer to the temporary support that is used in concrete construction.
Most typically, that's true. That
has there ever been a time when it's been used to include structural elements in this context?
I'm not aware of a case where this standard has been cited in exactly this kind of a situation. But it does.
Well, in any kind of a situation,
it does fall within
a citation that has expanded that definition of formwork.
Well, we don't believe, with all respect, Your Honor, we don't believe that it expands the definition because the definition refers to the total system of support. The definition does not limit the scope of the standard only to temporary forms, and it does not, by its terms, exclude permanent forms. And the fact is that there's a lot of evidence in the record that there are such things as permanent forms, starting first of all with the underlying contract here 2 years before the collapse occurred. It's at Appendix A1377. It says thin section semi-finished precast concrete panels are permanent integrated forms which, when combined with a poured in place concrete topping, creates a composite concrete deck system. So right from the beginning of this project, they understood that these permanent, what were going to become the permanent slabs, the filigree containers, the tubs that then were filled with a topping of concrete, these were permanent forms. Later in the-
I'm catching up with you now, Mr. Chartoff.
Sorry.
Page 1377?
Correct. I'm sorry, that's at paragraph A in the middle of the page. Panels are permanent integrated forms. And then turning to appendix A1226, which is Fabi's consultant report in the middle of the page.
1226?
1226. Phil agrees a proprietary system consisting of precast concrete slab and beam shelves that serve as a permanent form for the cast-in-place concrete poured on-site. And further down in the consultant's report at A1278, forms for this project are the filigree planks that support the weight of wet concrete. They are a permanent part of the structure that are never removed. In addition to that, we've cited the testimony at the hearing from a representative of the manufacturer filigree who referred.
Excuse me one moment.
May I proceed?
Please.
Thank you. The testimony by the filigree manufacturer's representative, who described these forms as left-in-place forms, and even Fabi's consultant, we quoted a long passage of his testimony, who described them as a stay-in-place form. So we believe that the application of this standard here is wholly consistent with the definition of the total system of support. Mr. McCarron, the safety superintendent, said that the forms were supported on the form on level P8 was supported by the shoring going down three levels below, and that's also mentioned in the treatise by M.K. Hurd that's in the appendix, who also says that in multi-story construction, the upper level is supported by several slabs below. So it's not limited to temporary forms, and there was lots of reason for this company to understand on this project.
How do you construe the ALJ's language referring to that as a strained construction of the term framework?
Well, I wouldn't limit it just to strained. She did say strained, but not unreasonable, and she.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, I think she meant strained.
I'm asking, however, I'm limiting my question. How do you construe the use of the word strained?
I construe that, Your Honor, as unconventional, untypical, and we agree with that. Ordinarily, forms are temporary. They're stripped out at the end of the job or after the concrete has gained sufficient strength. But the universe of forms is not limited to forms that are stripped out. And this particular construction technique that was used at this project had slabs that ultimately became a permanent part of the building. Nevertheless, they were referred to by people up and down as being forms.
This document you referred to, 1226,
yes,
appears to be, it's entitled Evaluation of OSHA Citations Issued to Fabi.
Right, that's Fabi's consultant report.
How did this come to your attention?
That's in the record. That's one of the exhibits.
And it was put in by Fabi?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's an R exhibit, not a C.
Not with the purpose that you're now, for which you're now using it.
Well, I can't speak to their goals there.
Well, I'm sure we'll find out on rebuttal.
It was mentioned that early on the eve of the hearing, was Fabi made aware of the Secretary's theory about formwork, and that's simply not true. Again, referring to Fabi's consultant report, which is dated March 15th, I believe. It's mid-March in any event, 2 months before the hearing began. This is at page A1294, the paragraph A. OSHA contends that the permanent slab construction can be considered as formwork supporting level P8. This definition allows OSHA to invoke the OSHA formwork regulations in citing Fabi for steel reinforcement placement issues described in citation 1, item 1. So clearly, they knew well in advance of the hearing what OSHA's theory was, and they had ample time to develop anything in opposition to defend that position. They mentioned today reliance.
We have to clarify one thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that the slabs at issue in this case are the forms in the filigree method?
Correct. The filigree method is used to create the slabs at parking level 5, 6, 7, and 8. And between connecting those levels are different kinds of shoring. And that total system of support under the OSHA definition constitutes formwork. This is not a novel obligation that's being placed on the contractor to safeguard its employees. And as the court has noted, this was an experienced contractor. They were being paid $47 million to do this concrete project. It's a 10-story parking garage on top of 3 or 4 stories of retail. It takes up more than a whole city block. And a company that engages in this kind of construction, major commercial construction, and that knows about industry practice has to free its work site of recognized hazards. And they knew that the failure to use any longitudinal steel along the exterior beams, cutting through the core of the columns, that was against industry practice. None of the drawings, structural or shop drawings, showed any such steel. What they should have done was follow up, make sure, is this a mistake or not? But they took no action. This is best exemplified by several statements by the superintendent, Mr. McCarron, who said, well, nobody questioned it. Nobody raised it to me. But that doesn't meet their obligation to free the work site of recognized hazards. They have to take some action to safeguard the employees. And the same is true of the mesh. In that instance, they didn't rely on what the engineers or the architects did. They took it upon themselves to deviate from the drawings that prescribed where and how to place the mesh. So they can't say that we were relying on other specialists, because they didn't. And another point they made was that they were relying on the two inspectors, the inspectors that were hired by Keating, the site Blofeld people, and then the inspectors from the city of Atlantic City. Reliance has to be reasonable. Reliance has to be considered when you know there's no longitudinal steel, when you know that, or when you believe that the drawings showing the mesh can't be done, and you take it upon them yourself to depart from them, you can't simply say, because nobody questioned it, because these inspectors apparently acquiesced in it, something that they too should have known if they were competent. Those inspectors could have seen that there was no longitudinal steel. It's a mystery why they allowed that to go through. They simply did not have a basis for reasonably relying on what the inspectors did. And
one finite point, there was a violation at which the original fine had been $2,500 and then it was raised to $7,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can that be done without giving a reason or without explanation? Can we affirm that with no reason or explanation?
Well, it was not until their reply brief that they said clearly, they alleged clearly, they thought this was a simple mistake, an obvious mistake. And I admit that when I read their opening brief, I thought that they were challenging the authority of the judge to assess a penalty higher than was proposed. But now that I understand that what their objection is a mistake, I concede there may well have been a mistake here, but I don't
think your inability to come to grips with it, because I share your problem there.
I don't think it's obvious, however, that the judge intended, I mean, she says, I'm assessing the penalty as proposed, comma, as set forth in the order below. Was the mistake when she said as proposed, or when, which was 2,500, or was it when it says as in the order where she said 7,000? We believe then, rather than asking you to speculate about what Judge Rooney intended, the much better outcome would be a very limited remand, just to get her to clarify.
Remand that question to determine the proper penalty for that citation.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
I'm going to take you back once more, I'm sorry, to the slabs. And here's the question. Is it your position that the distressed slabs at issue in this case were the filigree framework slabs?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that all of the slabs in the building were filigree slabs.
So therefore, including the distressed ones.
I'm sorry?
Including the distressed slabs, then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. The method of construction for the slabs was to use these precast, what they call tubs. They're very thin shells, I believe the record says 2 3/4 inches, and then you lay them down over the beams, and then you come in and pour, I think, over 10 inches worth of concrete. That's how they built all of the levels of the parking garage. Is there any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Short.
Thank you.
Thank you. 2 minutes.
Your Honors, with respect to these precast tubs, they were purchased by Fabi from Filigree System. Filigree pre-engineered precast these tubs. These tubs were just not simply, an aluminum tub that's shrunk down there. The reason why Fabi purchased them was because they relied on Filigree's expertise. And when they were laid, if you see a picture of them, and they're included in parts of the appendix, they already have certain rebar that's built into those things coming up, going longitudinally, going vertically. So to try to say that, in fact, this temporary formwork, there should be an exception for this when someone lays filigree tubs, would still put Fabi in the position of an engineer responsible for design defects.
How about the notice question that you say that the company was not on notice before the hearing, or the day, night before, that formwork was going to include structural, permanent structural members? The government's attorney has offered record citation to your documentation referring to that interpretation at earlier dates. What do you say to that?
Judge, then I would concede I made a mistake.
Okay.
I know the first time I became aware of it was when counsel for the secretary and I discussed it about a week before the start of the hearing. And in fact, in the pre-hearing statement, you'll see in the pre-hearing statement, the secretary is still alleging that there were insufficient number of shores. So I think they were probably trying to play it both ways. With regard to the longitudinal bars, the shop drawings provide that the longitudinal bars were not going to go through the column core. That's an engineering decision. Now the judge says, and she pulls it out of thin air, that Fabi knew or should have known that would have compromised the structural integrity. Where does that come from? How can a contractor make that type of engineering decision? They had already built 8 levels of this garage. If that was such an obvious mistake, to an experienced contractor or layman, then this thing would have collapsed long before that. They complied with the shop drawings, which is precisely what the ALJ.
What do you say about the mesh steel, where apparently contractor's position was we couldn't do it the way the drawings had said, so we did it a different way?
Well, what Mr. McCarron said is that they pushed it up against the parapet wall. They pushed it as far as they could push it. Mm-hmm. And he said that in his understanding, that's exactly what was called for in that situation. My position, Judge, would be that if you look at the small-scale drawing that the government relies on, and it's a single drawing, there's nothing in that drawing that has notes, as it should have, is for the level of mesh embedment into the columns. Now, Mr. Gudelhofer, our expert, said that the mesh was never intended to be embedded in the columns. It was intended to bind the beams and the slabs because it was just laid over them, so there was no issue of embedment. So our position is that the drawing, the single drawing that the government relies on, does not call for mesh embedment. It's just a small-scale drawing, which is to show the general placement of the mesh. If you look at the filigree drawings, and I think there's five or six of them that are in the record, they each have details. And those details show that the mesh is pushed up against the crash or parapet wall and goes no further. We would submit that those details, if, in fact, I think the record reflects that those details, that Mr. Gudelhofer testified, that those details were consistent with the structural drawings which were done by the engineer. So obviously the engineer's intent here was for there to be no embedment. And you have both Mr. McCarron, the superintendent, and Mr. DeStefano, who was the foreman of the workers putting in the mesh, saying that this was the way that it was done, that they didn't consider it to be hazardous, and that neither of them interpreted it to mean that the mesh was to be embedded into the columns.
Okay.
Thank you, judges.
Okay. Thank you. Aronak, Gordon, Chortel, thank you. All the cases submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.